You are listening to High Plains Public Radio. Thank you so much for being here with us. We hope you're having a great morning. I'm Jenny Inzerillo. I'm live in the studio. And guess what? I had a chat lined up with this gal. That's right. From last week. And I call her and she's got a flat tire. She's on the side of the road. So I am so excited to be chatting today with Jamie Harris. You might know her from the album we've had in heavy rotation, an acoustic reimagining of songs from her previous album, Red Rescue. The new album is the Congress House Sessions, and I'm so excited to talk to her about it. And you also, if you checked out the Folk Unlocked High Plains Public Radio Texas Room Showcase, you will definitely recognize her from that as well. Jamie, thank you so much for being here with us today, and I hope that tire drama went okay.
Yeah, thank you so much for rescheduling and having me on despite the auto challenges. The car is back on the road. Everything's good. Just had to be patched up, little nail, I guess. So we're rolling down the road again.
Nice. Well, we are no strangers to nails and tires here on the High Plains. It's usually pieces of stuff coming off of trucks and just bashing into your windshield more often than not.
Yeah, I've learned a lot more about that since I moved to Tennessee. Of course it makes sense. Nashville is like the center of the country, so there are so many trucks here. You know, I ran over some mystery stuff. My tire could be flat again right now. I have no idea.
the mystery stuff.
The mystery stuff, yeah.
Well, let's chat real quick. First, most people might know you from being in Austin, Texas. You're a Waco native. You have recently moved up to Tennessee in Nashville. But most people would recognize you as a singer, songwriter, guitarist. You're also an incredible collaborator and work with so many different artists. And your genre, I love that you call it folk and roll. I love It's like, yeah, you're right. It is kind of like a little mashup. So many of the artists we play on High Plains Public Radio are also just kind of across all genres. It's going to get to the point where there just aren't genres. There's just noises and sounds for what kind of music somebody makes. But we are very excited that you were able to be in the Texas Room for the Folk Unlocked Showcase, sponsored by the Texas Music Office. And it was such a delight to know that we were going to have you on that right as the Congress House Sessions was coming out. Red Rescue was your album from 2018. And of course, we played that quite a bit on this show. And now we have these stripped down versions of seven of the songs, an acoustic version of these. And I just am so excited to talk to you about this because this is kind of one of those EPs that feels very much like it's come out of a bit of the pandemic. Let's just slow it down. Let's just focus on what the music and the lyrics are and hear the poetry of it. It was released on March 5th, and we just want to hear a little more about how has the reception been as these songs have come out and people have gotten to hear them.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I a lot of people have asked me if this was a pandemic record because of the nature of the record, because it's reimagined and stripped down. We actually made this at the Congress House 2 weeks before everything shut down.
Wow.
Which is kind of interesting. So, yeah, of course, initially before people heard it, I got a very predictable question. Why would you do this? Why would you take seven songs and re-record them and put this out? And my initial answer was, I don't exactly know. I'm just following my gut here. But the reception has been great. A lot of people have told me that they feel like they're connecting to these songs in a different level, on a different level, because it feels more vulnerable. Because my voice and my just me, I'm more at the center of it. And that was the inspiration for making this EP in the first place, because I went from playing with a 7-piece rock band in Austin to everything in my life changing, leaving my day job, going full time, being in a serious romantic relationship, and touring full time as a solo artist alone on stage with an acoustic guitar and my voice and my stories, playing to audiences that have never heard me before, have no idea who I am, and are pretty much waiting for a headliner to come on. So that was terrifying, because I feel like the troubadour thing, which of course so many of my favorite artists are troubadours or were troubadours, those who have passed away. And I learned that that is a skill set that I had not developed in all my years of performing live. But I got stronger every night. And after coming off of the road for a brief period of time in March of 2020, or February 2020, before everything shut down for real in March, I decided that it was important for me to capture these songs after a year of playing them that way. It's like I needed to capture them for myself in a way to know what I had done, because everything went by so, so fast that I couldn't exactly gauge the growth.
Well, it's almost like it seems like you'd lived with them for a while and now you were able to actually paint them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, because it's interesting. The seven that you chose, and I believe what there were four that didn't make it onto the Congress House sessions. Is that right?
I think three, yeah.
Three, okay. So the ones that you chose, and the album, you're right, it does have like kind of a heavy rock band sound to it at times, but the lyrics are very intimate, just personal to me. And so having it as an acoustic album, I was able to really hear the lyrics in a different way when it was just you and a guitar. And I recently, because of South by Southwest, I was able to see the new Guy Clark documentary, and he actually talks about this. He hated his first albums because of the production, not to blame Nashville, but to blame Nashville. And he talked about, you have to take all the BS away so that you can just hear what I'm trying to say. So to me, this was very much like in that vein of, we're going to take everything else away and I'm just going to communicate with you. And these are my only tools. And that's all I got. I have to make it work and it has to be powerful.
Wow. I can't wait to see that Guy Clark movie.
Oh, it's so good.
I am like, so I think they're doing a screening of it tonight. I am so excited to see that. Yeah. I mean, you know, when I was talking about Troubadours a few seconds ago, I was thinking about Guy Clark. You know, Guy Clark, I think, considered himself a folk singer and played to what, 150, 200 people a night with pretty much him and a guitar, Verlin, and his stories, and was able to hold a room with his incredible songs, and his stories. And, it's a really unique, there's a unique set of skills that you have to acquire or develop, I guess, in order to perform songs in that way. And I think for some artists, it comes very natural. I think Guy's one of them. You know, Mary Gaucher, you know, I got to watch her every night absolutely crush it. Like Towns, she has these jokes or just like, she has these moments of levity in between really dark songs. And that was something I hadn't developed on stage. And so when it came to choosing the seven songs, for the Reimagine, I think I chose songs that I learned how to talk about on stage in a way where it wasn't just, here's my story, because obviously, or I guess obviously to me, what I've learned, maybe not obviously, but what I've learned is that the deeply personal allows us to connect to the universal, mm-hmm. right? When someone hears a song like Snow White Knuckles, they think that's in recovery or has been in a difficult relationship, they're not thinking like, oh, poor Jamie Harris, she went to jail and has had these struggles. That person is thinking, this is my song. This is what I went through. This is what I'm going through right now. This is what my daughter is going through, my son. So I was able to figure out how to take these songs, which were born out of deeply personal experiences, and figure out a way to maybe tell a story about alternatives to the criminal justice system. Like there's a treatment center, or not a treatment center. It's called Women in Recovery. It's in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it's alternative to the criminal justice system for women who have been convicted of alcohol or drug related offenses. And it's rehabilitative. They provide housing and food, educational resources. And I didn't know that Oklahoma incarcerates more women than any other state in our country. So I'm able to talk about that on stage and not say exactly, here's what happened to me and these are the facts. Or, you know, I'm able to get out of my head and talk about social justice issues that matter to me with these songs.
And, you know, like you said, these songs do have, they cover quite a wide array of things. You've got lost love, you've got self-doubt, you've got these emotional challenges, from some of which just could be interpreted so many different ways, you know, in overcoming your own nature as an inquisitor, as a critic. Given that people are that listen to Red Rescue and then hear the acoustic versions, it's, you know, we have so many different things. Obviously, during the pandemic, so many people took to the, you know, virtual settings and recording things so that the people who were thirsting for human connection and really hungry for, you know, live music, because it's such a healing thing, especially to people of the High Plains in our region. And we have a concert series, and that's just missed. And having these songs, you might know them, but now you're hearing them in a very different way. It almost seems like, oh, this is the unplugged version of these types of things. It really does change how you ingest that message. And I'm wondering for you, how was it? Because you have to change how you sing them and how you phrase things and maybe where you're going to play with your vocals on it. How was it for you to take them, consider how you wanted to switch it up for the acoustic version? And were you shocked what you had on the other side of that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was, you know, skills that were developed when I was on the road solo, right? Because I had to learn, like, I think as a woman, there are things that I can do with my voice that I've shied away from in my own writing because I don't want to be known as a chick singer. I want to be known as a songwriter. And you said, you mentioned that I collaborate with a lot of artists. One of the things that I love about collaborating with other artists is that I get to use my voice in ways that I might not necessarily write into my own songs, or that I guess I should say rather that the songs might not ask of me. The songs that kind of come through me might not ask for me to belt or to do something crazy with my voice or use certain ranges. But when all I have on a stage is my voice and my guitar, I learned, wow, I really have to be more dynamic with my voice because that's what's controlling the show, right? And my guitar playing, I'm not trying to sit in a pocket of a band, you know, that it has a fiddle player and a piano player and a guitar player and an awesome drummer. Like, I have to be the rhythm, really. I have to make it interesting and make it interesting for me every night, which inspire me to reach for things vocally. Because one of the things about my live show that I love, and I did incorporate on this record with two harmony singers, is, you know, when you've got harmonies like we had structured them and how I'd been playing live, that kind of locks you into a certain melody. Well, I was able to reach for notes that I had never done before because I don't have two other voices following me. And so that, I feel like I came into the studio with that approach. But it wasn't until after the record was finished and I got to hear it back that I was able to kind of see why other people were saying that it was really vulnerable. And it was, because it is, it's me at the center of it, you know, letting out those feelings and going back into those experiences of when I wrote it. But other than that, you know, the two harmony singers that sang with me on the record, Chris Nelson and Jane Ellen Bryant, they were my roommates. So we had literally sat around campfires at Kerrville singing songs, or in our backyard singing songs, these songs, in the car. So it was really easy for them to follow me because we almost have like a spooky like ESP thing going on between the three of us.
Stage telepathy.
Yeah.
So speaking of Congress House sessions, let's talk real quick for those who aren't aware. What is Congress House? And let's hear a little bit about the production of this particular album, because it's so based in the place where they were recorded and the person with whom you worked.
Yeah. So the Congress House Studio is a studio on South Congress in Austin, Texas. And I became hip to the Congress House Studio after I became pretty much obsessed with Eliza Gilkison's music. I was kind of late to discovering her work, and I saw her play at a festival in Dripping Springs. We were both on the same festival, and I stayed in the parking lot after she played and downloaded every record she ever made. I was like, it just blew my mind, discovering that artist. And, you know, it's a little bit harder now without physical CDs to figure out who made this record, you know, where was it made, who played guitar on it. And so I did some research and I found out very quickly that Mark Hallman at the Congress House Studio had made these records. And Mark Hallman was a guy that I had run into several times in Austin at parties, and we would always just kind of end up talking to each other. And so my mind was kind of blown, like the guy I talked to at parties has made all these records. Then I found out he worked with Ani DiFranco and Tom Russell, and he worked with Carole King. And so I was like, Mark, you made these records. And that began kind of, that kind of deepened our friendship. And I was invited to sing on other projects at the Congress House studio. So I knew that I wanted to work with Mark for quite a long time. And it felt like Mark has seen my band live more than anybody I know, that's a producer in Austin. So he's seen me with the trio. He's seen me solo. He's seen me with the 7-piece band, and he really knows what my voice can do. And I figured he would be the perfect person because he's seen all of those different versions and because he's really big on allowing the artist to discover what the right thing is. He's not going to tell us, you know, like come down like God and say, you must not play it this way or you should try this. You know, he'll let us experiment and then have a listen and kind of guide us to what he thinks would work best. But it definitely feels like I get to learn in the process and improve my artistry under his guidance.
Do you feel like there was something about that space in particular that really, you know, informed the way that you presented these songs?
I think so. You know, it's a really, really comfortable place to make a record. And plus I'd been able to sing on other people's records there. So I was familiar with, you know, also Andre Moran, who's the engineer there, and just the physical space. And, you know, Mark lit a bunch of candles when I got kind of, stressed out. He lit a bunch of prayer candles, and they have really good coffee there. It's just really comfortable. I mean, even Ray Bonneville, who's another one of my favorite artists, stopped by because he was in the neighborhood and had lunch with us and ended up playing harmonica on Red Rescue. I mean, it's that kind of, you never know who's going to drop in and be a part of what's happening. It's just, artists love it because it's so comfortable and has all this history. And it's, you know, a little bit of me is, of course, thinking like, I love that there are all these posters of Eliza Gilkison on the wall. Like, she's like just one of my heroes, and I want to soak up any amount of energy that she's left in those rooms.
Yeah, her energy just seeping out. Well, it's kind of cool to have a space where you can record like that. It almost operates like a salon where you've got different people who are, you know, familiar with that kind of music and the artists that would perform there. And then you get to be able to, you know, leech off of their talent if they happen to be there when you're there.
Yeah.
Now, you've been into music since you were a kid, but you, like you said, you've only recently made it like a full-time job. Can you tell listeners who maybe don't know much about your backstory just a little bit about how you came into music initially and then made songwriting and performing your calling and what you do?
Yeah, thank you for asking. So, yeah, when I was 5 years old, I became obsessed with this Emmylou Harris Christmas song called Light of the Stable. I kept putting it on repeat, and that's what hipped my parents to the fact that I was really into music. So I got a guitar for Christmas, and my dad taught me how to play. And then I got super into Fleetwood Mac, and after the dance record came out, and played cover songs in between the set breaks of my dad's cover band. So my parents had me really young, and my dad played in a cover band to put himself through college. So I would play cover songs and the little set breaks. And he always told me, you know, I think you should maybe try songwriting. I think that would be a really great thing for you. But I didn't really start writing songs until I think I was about 13 or 14. And one of the big things that really pushed me into that was I got to see Patty Griffin play at the very first Austin City Limits Music Festival. And she sang with Buddy Miller and Julie Miller and Emmylou Harris. And to see Julie Miller, who spent quite a bit of time in Waco, on that stage was really inspiring too, because being from Waco, I was like, wow, here's someone that is a wonderful songwriter and that is singing with Emmylou Harris and Patty Griffin and is in this world that I want to be a part of with this type of music. And she's from Waco. That was really inspiring to me. So I started writing after that and played in a duo with my dad for quite some time. Then ended up moving to Austin, was in different duos and trios, and was playing around, but I was kind of in the hipster scene, which I still don't know why, because I'm not hip, I'm not cool. You know, I'm definitely a folky at heart. And I guess around 2013, 2014, I started hanging out at Strange Brew, which is a coffee shop venue that has since closed. And there's a gospel brunch there with John D. Graham, Jeff Plankenhorn, Sela, and Scrappy Judd Newcomb. And I ended up getting sober after my second arrest. And after I got sober, I would hang out at that coffee shop all the time because they had music from like 10 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night. So I would just stay there and drink coffee and see a lot of incredible local artists play there. And the guys at the gospel brunch started inviting me to come up and share my songs. And I think being in Austin for as long as I was always looking for that kind of audience. You know, I knew they were at the Cactus Cafe, but I was like, where are these fans that like Patty Griffin and Emmylou Harris and James McMurtry's solo stuff or acoustic stuff? Where are they? You know, obviously the Continental Gallery, but Strange Brew, going to that gospel brunch, it was always packed. So all of a sudden I'm, you know, pretty much playing songs newly sober to an audience of 100 people every Sunday because the folks at Gospel Brunch were kind enough to invite me up. And that's really not only when I started to find my real writer's voice. Like, I feel like Snow White Knuckles is kind of the first song that I wrote that really feels like a Jamie Harris song, but I was able to play it to an audience that likes what I do and likes similar artists. So that allowed me to steadily grow a fan base. And eventually I was, you know, Jimmy LaFave was extremely helpful, getting me in front of audiences, just telling people about my music. Going to Folk Alliance was a huge deal for me the first time in 2018. But I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I knew I didn't want to play cover songs. I wanted to play original music and I wanted to present it in a way that made sense for what my vision was. And so I never wanted to confuse fans about what I did. So I worked a day job that had nothing to do with music in order to support playing with a band or with a trio. And we got a residency at another club called One to One. And we just played. We worked really hard every week or, you know, a couple times a week. We just did everything that we could. And finally, I realized, okay, I'm not having to dip into my pocket to pay my own band. I'm able to do that with the ticket sales. And I just kind of got this gut feeling in 2018 that said, this is the year. I don't know what's going to happen, but this is the year that I go full time. And on paper, it didn't look so great, actually. It really didn't, but it turned out to be the right year.
And it's interesting to hear that there was this space with all these different songwriters. And of course, Austin, one of the live music venue, capitals of the world. And then you've got people playing acoustic, people surrounding you that are also songwriters, people that do instruments differently. And that's kind of what you're surrounding yourself with. And this importance of having that space, given that we've just now been missing those spaces for over a year now, it just makes you think, like, I wonder what kind of catch up we're going to have to be doing in the arts, and how everyone who is an advocate for the arts maybe has to come in double, or the next Jamie Harris is going to just be like stuck there on a Zoom call watching a webinar.
Right. Well, it's yeah.
But it's funny to think, you know, you start off with this acoustic, you know, you get in front of people and then you kind of go to having large rock bands. And this album was a little bit about going back to being confident in front of an audience now that you have the songs and you have a hold on the songs. And I bet most people, I mean, I don't play music. I interact with it quite a bit. But to me, it seems like you kind of almost went from having the rock band and having to draw back into having it more stripped down and having those storytelling songs and just having you in an audience and an intimate connection and conversation.
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot, you know, it's kind of funny to be, I guess, talking about the Congress House sessions and looking towards the next thing. But like what's resulted too beyond the Congress House sessions is that, like I was talking about earlier, the having to be on stage and tell stories has inspired me as a writer to try to tell other people's stories, or at least tell the stories from behind different narrators' eyes. So this next batch of songs I've got a song written from the perspective of a grieving mother that's lost her son to a gun accident. I've got a 16-year-old kid at Walmart that works at Walmart that's knocked up his girlfriend. So I'm kind of like telling, this whole thing has affected, above all else, my songwriting skills.
And it sounds like those two, at least, you're keeping it very Texas.
Yep. You can take the girl out of Texas, but don't even try to take the Texas out of me.
Well, I love that you know, the fact that you're kind of going back into a songwriter troubadour tradition. And of course, folk music has its roots in social justice. And you mentioned your social justice work with criminal justice reform. And one of the first things, I don't know if you've Googled yourself recently, but it literally is one of the first thing, criminal justice reform activist. And recently it was at Folk Alliance, which everything was virtual, everything was online, and almost everyone, if they were a presenter, if they were an artist, didn't matter, had activist after their name. And knowing that we've been dealing with so much after this last year and having that time to pause and think inward about what world we want, I do feel like the musicians of the United States of America are coming forward with quite a bit of incredible social justice leaning music and forcing people to think. And the lyrics, therefore, are very, very important. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, you wanting to have that be something that is central to what you do with your work?
Yeah, well, it came out of my experience. I mean, my experience was that when, basically the second time I got out of jail, I was only in jail for, I think, 5 days. And I, as a result of getting a text message from a songwriter, Betty Sue, who I met the night that I went to jail, unrelated, she asked me if I would open a gig for her a couple months down the line. And I thought maybe I could quit drinking long enough to do that, because I didn't know how I was going to quit drinking. I mean, I was really pretty suicidal. I was thinking, there's no way I can quit drinking. I'm just going to have to go to jail for a year, which actually seems like maybe that's the best thing for me to do. You know, just get me away from alcohol for a year, or I just don't know if I can continue to live. And so getting that message from her really inspired me. And, you know, but as a result of being in the criminal justice system, I was basically the county wanted to send me to outpatient rehab. And I said, okay, that makes sense. And I had insurance at the time, which was miraculous that I even had insurance. I think it was through Obamacare that year. And I went for an assessment and I found out that my insurance told me that at 60 days sober, I was too sober for my insurance to cover the cost of rehab. And there's no way I could afford to pay for it. And so at 75 days sober, I went back to the county and the county suggested to me to start drinking again to reset my sobriety date. Mm. So my insurance would cover going to rehab. And I had some privilege that allowed me to say, I'm not going to do that. That's like, this is the longest I've been able to remain sober in my life. Like, I can't imagine hitting the reset on it. Like people could die when you tell them that, if you give them that guidance. And I think at the time, I mean, it was devastating to me and it was confusing to me. And the more that I think about it, the angrier I become. Because what do you do if you're not in a position to pay for rehab and you're going to go to jail if you can't meet those requirements, you know, or you're told to start drinking again? That's a death sentence for people. And so I guess I think about someone like my grandmother who's passed away, who's a wonderful woman. She was one of the first women deacons at the First Baptist Church of Waco. You know, she was kind of awesome. But she probably thinks that, okay, you know, criminal justice system, you do what is asked of you, you follow the rules, and then you get out. And that's just not how it works. Mm-mm. There's so many holes for people to step into. And so, you know, I know there's so many issues with the American criminal justice system, but really where my focus is in an effort to stop using incarceration as a response to addiction. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about it, you know, this might seem kind of crazy, but you're talking about artists and more social justice issues coming up in music now, which is great, I think. But I watched that Britney Spears documentary. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh, I have.
Oh, you have? Great. And I thought they made such a good point when Britney was going through all that, you know, the difficult stuff with her divorce and mental health, that we weren't having a conversation about mental health, mm-mm, even then, to the level that we are now.
And, you know, it's such a different world now. I was just discussing this with a colleague about, you know, even people who are, you know, Gen X versus people who are older now, the rapidity with which things are changing and evolving, you do have to check yourself. And a lot of things are really bad right now, but you know what? A lot of things are so much better, and people do recognize mental health. People aren't ashamed of it as much. There is still extreme problem with the addiction. It's going through the roof, but at least there's conversations about it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I do know during the pandemic, obviously the need for substance use recovery services has skyrocketed.
Mm-hmm.
From people I know in the recovery community that specifically that work in rehabilitation centers or that work to get funding to send folks to rehabilitation centers so that they're able to go. Anyways, that need for that has skyrocketed. Obviously, the isolation, the financial insecurity, a lot of things that we're facing during COVID, and so it's been a great time to be in recovery. Oddly, to have a group of people that I see regularly, you know, on Zoom, that are, you know, we're just trying to take it one day at a time. It's really helped me, and I think a lot of other people in recovery, get through this.
And so many people are going to need people like you on the other side of it to be an inspiration and to stay strong through whatever happens.
We all need each other. I have had some dark times in the barrel, and folks have come and lifted me out. So, you know, it's a team effort for sure.
And with that, we're going to now talk about your favorite things, roller coasters and pinball machines.
Oh, great.
Smooth transition. It is one of the things that I have seen written about you. And as someone who also very much appreciates that, and it's kind of one of those things where if you love roller coasters a lot and you have a lot of people in your life that just despise them, I normally can say, I get it. It's scary. I don't get it with not liking roller coasters. I really am just like, who are you? What's wrong with you? How are you on the same planet as me?
Really? So you're a roller coaster freak?
Big time.
Oh my gosh. So what are some of your favorites?
Well, I don't know the names of the one that I went to in Sandusky, Ohio, that felt like it went to the moon and then flipped down. But that one was great. But I grew up in Kansas City, where we had Worlds of Fun. So we had all kinds of roller coasters there, and I would just ride them on loop. I would spend the whole summer just riding them. So you have a big affinity toward roller coasters and pinball machines as well, which I know many people who are arcade heads. What about these childhood kind of thrills? What do you think draws you to those types of things?
You know, I think it had something to do with traveling. Once I started doing some more gigs, I was like, well, how close are we to a roller coaster? Like, that became part of my deal. I have a friend named Barry Lynn who is retired now, but he's a minister, and he did work for the American Association for the Separation of Church and State. And he was like an MSNBC correspondent, brilliant, brilliant guy. He did the same thing when he would have speaking engagements. He'd just figure out, well, how far are we from a roller coaster? But I think also it helps me think in a way, and it helps me unlock ideas. Like, there's something about pinball, especially, like, or, you know, walking is a great example for a lot of people, you know, to when I'm stuck with a song, or I don't have vision for maybe a project I'm working on, or my gut hasn't clicked in yet with an idea related to music or just something else in my life. I can go get lost in a pinball machine. You know, where my body is moving, my brain is working, but there's this other part of my brain that's working while I'm active, you know, throwing a pinball around. And the roller coaster, I don't know, I just love the thrill of it. I recently went to Dollywood. It was my first time there, and I didn't realize that. Well, first of all, if you put a woman in charge of a theme park, my goodness, it's a whole different world. Dollywood is unbelievable, and I had no idea. But she has this thing called the lightning rod there, which is the fastest wooden roller coaster in the world.
I'm so jealous. I want to go to Pigeon Forge.
Come on. Well, let's go ride some roller coasters. Come on up.
And I love that you said roller coasters. You sounded very Texans right there. Well, yeah, it's just, I don't know. I really miss amusement parks right now. Like, this is making me realize, like, I don't know. It sounds like the pinball is almost just like a type of like mid 20th century meditation or something.
Yeah, you know, with the skee ball too. I was a competitive skee ball roller for a little bit, and I think the connection with skee ball for me was that when I was a kid, you know, I grew up in the 90s, and I was a terrible roller skater. And for some reason, everyone had roller skating birthdays in the 90s, and I just hated it. You know, so instead of skating, I would always go to the skee ball lane and roll, and I got kind of naturally good at it. And so anytime I saw one of those, I definitely have a deep like childhood connection for the skee ball thing more than the pinball. But the pinball, I guess they're easier to find, I found out, than skee ball lanes when you're traveling. And so I got kind of sucked into that world.
Well, this last part, I wanted to do something kind of fun because I know that you might be able to really come through for this. I wanted to do a lightning round. Now, just to warn you, a lot of these questions are just kind of don't think about them too much. And if you want to pass, you just say pass. This is going to be super, super random. So clear your head. This is pinball now.
Okay.
Favorite Emmy Lou song?
That's okay. Red Dirt Girl.
Default quarantine uniform of choice.
Okay. And a day something borrowed shirt and no pants.
Excellent. Best thing about Folk Alliance International conferences, the in-person ones, not the virtual.
The random late night jams that happen when everyone is delirious.
Top three roller coasters in the U.S.
Ooh, that I've been on. Well, I have I don't know if they're the top three, but the top three for me, I love the Mr. Freeze. It shoots you backward. It shoots you out really fast. It's super, super, super fun. I got to put the Lightning Rod just because it's recent and it's the fastest wooden roller coaster I've been on. And I have a soft spot for the Iron Rattler in San Antonio as well.
All right. Favorite thing about working with Ray Wiley Hubbard?
Everything that comes out of his mouth.
I believe that. Most intense Gretchen Peters song.
Ooh.
Oh, that's hard.
You can pass. They're all extremely intense.
They're all extremely intense.
Not all. Not
I think
all.
There's something about Wichita.
Mm-hmm.
Really good. Wichita or Blackbirds.
Okay. Best advice you've ever received from a fellow songwriter?
To trust your gut.
Grossest candy you've ever eaten?
Well, I just don't like Reese's peanut butter cups.
I'm here for that.
I just don't like them.
What is a Townes Van Zandt lyric that really stays with you?
Think of all the poetry in the picking down the line.
Oh, that was a good one. Can you share a fond memory of your former mentor, Jimmy LaFave? We play him all the time on this show.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I have so many with Jimmy. But I have to say, this is a long story. But okay, so during the time when Jimmy was really, really sick, we were in Tulsa. I think it was April, and Jimmy passed away in May. And he played this show across the street from the Woody Guthrie Center. And I had had a lot of time with Jimmy, just being in the studio with him and going to the diner with him and just seeing him. And I kind of felt like, well, this is the Oklahoma thing. I'll kind of like hang back, you know, I don't want to be backstage or anything. But then I got kind of crowded and panicky, you know, like you do and when you're pre-grieving something. And so I decided I was going to go backstage, which required me to kind of walk half of a block. I had to go out the front of a building, walk around the block to get to the back. Well, I come back, Jimmy's playing, and everyone's like, just get on stage, get on stage, get on stage. I'm like, what's happening? So I get on stage, and he's singing this Bob Childers song called Restless Spirits. And I was like, okay, you know, that's kind of weird. And there's this woman up there. It's my friend Chris Buhalis, a great songwriter from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And this woman standing and singing with him. And I was like, well, I don't know who she is, but, you know, Jimmy knows a lot of people, and this is Oklahoma. Well, I find out right after the show that this woman on stage with him, he had asked me to sing with him. So he was calling me from the stage, you know, Jamie Harris. And I was outside, so I didn't hear him. And he called again, you know, Jamie Harris. And then he called again, and I still, you know, I wasn't there inside the building, so I didn't hear him. Well, there's this woman named Janie Harris, who is the marketing director for Hideaway Pizza, and she lived on the farm with Bob Childers. And so she said, well, I don't know why Jimmy would be calling me up there, but he said my name three times, and she knew the song because she had lived with Bob Childers. So what I heard about it was that, you know, I get on stage and, you know, Jimmy always sang with his eyes closed. And when this woman started singing, his eyes shot open. He was like, what's happening? But it was like one of those crazy moments that during that time that was really, really dark, the band and I sat up and laughed about it for a really, really long time. That's one. The other one I have to mention is he threw the show at the Paramount 3 days before he died. And he got on stage and sang Goodnight Irene. And we all thought it was going to come to a conclusion. And he said, one more time. And he sang and sang. And Ray Bonneville, after Jimmy left the stage, I mean, it was like, I couldn't even see how mm-hmm. sick he was. You know, I was just like, yes, Jimmy's on stage and he's singing. It was like, just, it felt so, it was the most powerful thing, hands down, I've ever been a part of. And Ray and I stood on the stage and looked at the spot where Jimmy was, kind of like when there's a shooting star in the sky and you kind of keep looking at the sky, knowing you're not going to see another shooting star in that spot again, but you're just kind of fixed on that spot. So I'll never forget that. It was just so powerful.
Oh, it's beautiful. And now we're going to go to Nashville versus Austin, who has the best coffee. I'm really good at transitions.
Austin, Third Coast Coffee, best coffee. we order it, actually. We get it shipped.
I love that that's a thing that humans can do now, is just order their favorite coffee from hometowns.
Yes.
Weirdest pinball machine art that you remember?
Weirdest pinball machine art?
I saw one time that was a bunch of cats, like anthropomorphic cats as surgeons. I don't remember where, but I just remember there must have been someone on a lot of PCP that designed some of those 70s pinball machines.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. There's a place in Smyrna, Tennessee, that's just a giant weird warehouse filled with them. And a lot of the weird 70s, early 80s ones with like any type of Tarzan looking men, those just kind of creep me out a little bit.
Like the Fabio. Yes,
exactly.
Fabio.
Exactly. Fabio.
I just sounded very Chicago. I was like, it's Fabio.
Fabio.
Saddest song by Mary Gaucher.
I'm just going to submit the Foundling album.
That's a great answer. Item from your childhood you would never get rid of.
Cow.
Who's that?
A stuffed animal that was a cow, and it had horns and udders, which was confusing. And now that I think about it, it makes a lot of sense for me.
Name a song you would love to hear Eliza Gilkison cover.
Oh. The Girl from the Red River Shore.
I'm going to have to tweet at her. Something you didn't realize you'd miss so much until lockdown happened.
Roller coasters. Obviously, being in the room with other people. I mean, just, my God.
I know. It's going to be so hard to go back, isn't it?
Any social skills that I had, which were so minimal, have totally evaporated.
We're going to work on it. We're going to have like webinars about it. Okay. Here's a good one. Three adjectives that you would use to describe your favorite guitar.
Warm. Is emotive an adjective?
Oh, sure. Everything's an adjective.
My grandmother's an English teacher. I'm like panicked now. I'm trying to think of a way to say this. Familiar.
Do your best Malcolm Holcomb impression.
Mert. Come on. F Trump. Come on.
Thank you so much. That was really good. All right. This is the last one. You've done incredibly. Music that's really been getting you through this pandemic.
Oh, Phoebe Bridgers.
All right, Jamie, you've done it. You've succeeded. You've made it to level 18. You're on the high score of this pinball machine of our interview. The Congress House Sessions is in heavy rotation on High Plains Morning. Jamie, We are so thrilled to have been able to chat with you about this. And I can't wait for you to see the Guy Clark documentary. I feel like so many things are going to come out. It was so much about towns. It was so much about Suzanne. It was so much about the people that got together and fostered one another's creativity. And I don't play music, but like I said, it was like the beauty of the collaborations that come out of artist communities and people supporting one another. And I feel like that's something that you and your music and your community really represents as well. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me and for all that you do for independent artists. It's really awesome to be here.
Well, now I've got to go try to pick through the world and find every one of those songs and artists that you mentioned so we can just play nonstop every single one of them. All right. You take care and you keep in touch. And I can't wait to see what's next after this. It's so crazy to think this album is what we're promoting right now. And you finished it so long ago.
Well, that's how it works, I think.
Well, so we'll be talking again soon then when you have all the new fabulous music about Surgeon Cats.
Surgeon Cats. I'm writing that down right now.
That's your prompt. All right, Jamie, thank you so much. Take good care of yourself and we'll be in touch hopefully soon.
All right. Thanks a bunch.